Hello everyone, welcome to Women Folk, a brand new podcast with me, Maria Wallace. I've been a grassroots music promoter under the name True North Music for the last 10 years, putting on gigs and booking tours for some of the finest artists in folk roots, bluegrass and Americana. This brand new podcast is all about telling the stories of women working in roots music, on stage and behind the scenes.
Honestly, finding out that the history was connected to my history made a really huge impact on me. I was really fortunate that I started to connect with other Black folks playing old-time music.
Today on Women Folk, I'm talking to Brandi Waller-Pace. Based in Texas, Brandi is the founder and organizer of the Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival, or FWAMFest for short. Brandi also sings and plays old-time music and has a keen interest in the banjo, both as a musician and a scholar. In 2019, Brandi founded the non-profit Decolonizing the Music Room, and she does a wide range of fascinating, important work as an educator, event presenter, speaker and musician. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Brandi Waller-Pace. Brandi's joining us from Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome, Brandi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. I know that you've been super busy and you've got so much going on as an educator, as a presenter, an event organizer, a musician and singer. I think one of your big projects you've just coming off the back of is the Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival.
Yeah. A few things kind of happen at the same time, but to make the story not crazy long, I was teaching elementary music and always picking up new instruments, stuff that looked fun to take in the classroom. And a lot of the training we have involves tons of like folk music or songs that I now know would be more old time repertoire. So one year I picked up the banjo and got really excited about it, dug deep into the history of it. Found out, you know, it's created by enslaved Africans in the Americas and was like, cool, I like this instrument. I like this clawhammer style I'm learning to play. And also it's part of my culture, which is not a commonly taught thing. So I started playing with an old time trio and started meeting other folks, going to a couple of festivals and camps and things like that. And I remember being at Augusta in West Virginia and us having some type of dialogue session about diversifying the music spaces. And we talked about, you know, why it's important to diversify existing spaces, but also create new ones. And I tend to get excited about creating new stuff. So I was like, I could do something down in Fort Worth. And I think a couple years later was when it premiered. And it feels like just a serendipitous convergence of things that allowed it to even happen in the first place. But I had friends who were willing to participate and send in video, and then we partnered with a local organization, Southside Preservation Hall, which is also the venue that we hold the festival in, and they had reached out to me and offered to let me do all the interstitial footage and such at the hall. So we really had a sleek product, and a local production company, Shiny Box Pictures, partnered as well. And so what we ended up having was like a live premiere of something that was, you know, packaged and included videos like we had grown used to watching all throughout the shutdown. And we went on from there.
Was that 2020 then? The original one, or was this March 2021?
2021. It was supposed to be 2020, but yeah.
So you know, had you originally planned it? Because that must have taken a huge amount of work to get to that point. Mm-hmm. Had you originally planned, was the seed of the idea as an in-person festival and then you adapted for that first year?
Yes, yes. It actually, I think we were aiming for, I don't know if we were aiming for spring 2020 or fall 2020, but I had partnered with a local nonprofit that had offered to be a fiscal sponsor, had really started like pulling together resources and looking at how to work with the location, all those things that, you know, one does when they're organizing events. As the shutdown happened and things got, you know, more and more dire, I just kept an eye on how the artists are feeling, and we decided to shift gears.
Were you able to go into a real life event the next spring?
Mm-hmm. And the next spring, that venue, Southside Preservation Hall, and we've been there ever since. And it was originally supposed to be an October festival, but I think it landing in the spring has been really nice.
Yes, and it's probably quite, is it mild in Fort Worth in March?
One never knows. It's all over the place. So we've had like a year where it was pretty cold, not, you know, like heavy cold weather, but pretty cold, a rainy year. This year, I think the weather was probably the best of all, and it was what you would probably call hot, because I really like to be warm.
Yeah, it's probably quite a bit warmer than over here in the north of England. But uh-huh. So you just wrapped up the latest edition a few weeks ago. So you had Don Fleming's headlining.
Mm-hmm, he was headlining.
And lots of other artists. So is it like one core day and that's where you have the performances? But I noticed you kind of added more sort of sessions. You've also got workshops and panels going on and educational talks.
Yeah. It's all one day. And so we have a ballroom, big main stage, and then there is a chapel, like a smaller, mm-hmm. Performance venue. And all of our sessions happen there, our workshops happen there. And there are performances there as well, but all of the presentations and such go there. And it's always been that side by side each year. But we are able to actually start filling out that time with cooler stuff or more stuff.
Yeah, it looks amazing. So have you found that you're sort of drawing in more and more people from out of state, from beyond the city, or like, is it kind of always been a balance of locals and people traveling to the event?
Yeah, there's been, you know, like a decent amount of locals, It's been a good amount of locals. What has changed is people coming from out of state or out of our metro area. The ways they found out about the festival and what brought them here has shifted. This year, we had the most out of metro area, out of state that we've had. It's been trending upward.
Because it's quite a unique event, isn't it? In terms of like the African-American roots music slant.
Yeah.
I can't think of another one. I know that the Biscuits and Banjos Festival is starting this year.
Yeah.
But up until now, I think yours has been like really in the vanguard of this. And you mentioned the role of the banjo. Even now, the banjo in general is seen as like associated with white, poor country folks, or certainly among the vast majority of people here in the UK, if you said banjo, what would be the association with it? And of course, there's been a lot of important work going on in recent years to counter that narrative. And yeah, it'd be interesting to get your take on what that means and how you've sort of come to being so involved with the banjo.
Yeah. Honestly, finding out that the history was connected to my history made a really huge impact on me. And I was really fortunate that I started to connect with other Black folks playing old time music, playing different forms of American roots music. And so I feel like the banjo is at the core of the whole event. It's something I always come back to and always try to have something grounded in old time and string band music, even though, as you said, we do branch into other forms.
For people listening who don't know, it'd be good to get your definition or explanation of what old time music is.
Yeah.
Because even though I'm fairly steeped in it, a lot of listeners won't be familiar with the term.
Yeah. So historically, it was really just a record label term that came about in the 20s, but it generally refers to string band music, early 1900s and earlier, very fiddle driven, banjo, after the turn of the century, when guitars began to be more mass produced, guitar became a part of it. And of course, now you'll hear bass sometimes, all kinds of other instruments added in, but it generally refers to that string band setup.
And something which kind of expresses one of the true American music styles, which, well, in my understanding, includes the sort of melding of European traditions and the fiddle, maybe some, you know, Scottish, Irish, English, whatever, with African-American, formerly enslaved peoples, and Native influences as well. Do all those come into that melting pot?
They do. And something that isn't talked about much, but there's some exciting writing coming out on it, is Black fiddle traditions.
Yeah.
From the African continent over. Because, you know, it's kind of an oversimplification to be like the European fiddle, the African stuff, because there's the story is so much more nuanced than that, even though it's all of the above, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's kind of that meld. And as you said, the Native indigenous influence is big in it too. And then when I remember when I was teaching my old time, you know, to little kids and to other educators, just making it clear that it's also very much dance music in a lot of context. Because, you know, over time, our music will just end up like on the stage separate from from the involvement. But something I love about old time is still very much like that dance will be in it, and that like community aspect.
Yeah. Going back a bit further in your own coming to old time music and coming to, well, even predating that, and you're talking about teaching music, I believe you studied jazz when you went to university.
Yeah.
That kind of strikes me as that's another purely American music form, which is generated by Black Americans, that has kind of become very co-opted across the world and across the decades. What was your sort of experience of studying?
So my undergrad and grad degrees in jazz studies I received from Howard University, which is a historically Black college in Washington, D.C. So me learning about jazz and jazz history was very much rooted in Blackness and lots of Black professors. Even when I was taking classical piano, I was being given pieces by Black composers. And so I had listened to jazz plenty before I went to school, but like my grounding in it as a musician was still very much like a Black tradition, while, you know, I was made aware that in a lot of other places, there's a lot of predominantly white music scenes or programs, stuff like that. So that level of like, you know, somewhat co-opting that happens with Black musics, even though we know that there's still like a melding of different cultures that made it up, is like, that was kind of a thing that I learned people will experience like outside of my educational setting. Not that everything was, you know, like a wonderland, but I just learned about it as like a very, very Black thing. And then getting into old time really just felt like kind of tracing the line backward.
Yeah. So I know that you play various instruments. Were you, when you were doing your degrees, were you kind of doing that on a particular instrument and singing, or what was the sort of main focus?
Yeah. Voice was my main focus. And I did like a couple of semesters of guitar, learning enough chords, but not really getting competent enough to like solo. But piano was kind of secondary. So I did like piano minor classes that were like Western European classical traditions, but also jazz piano. I played in my community jazz band and been able to hang in on piano and stuff, but voice is always like the first.
Sugar, baby, now. Got no sugar, honey, baby, now.
mentioned your university, Howard University.
Mm-hmm.
And this is known as like HBCU in the USA.
Mm-hmm. Historically Black College University. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a little bit about what those are like, and what, you know, what you got out of it, which was very positive in attending an HBCU rather than a different kind of university in the US?
Yeah, the HBCUs were established not across the country, but like a wide swath of the country. And a lot of them were land-grant universities after enslaved folks were emancipated during the Reconstruction period, where there was an attempt to push back against the disenfranchisement of Black folks mm-hmm. and give like actual, you know, political, legal power and so on and so on. A lot of these universities were established during that time, mm-hmm. Specifically to educate Black folks. But I'd encourage anyone listening to look it up, because there's a good amount of universities and there's such cool, unique history with each one. For me, going to an HBCU meant like I wasn't the only Black anything, mm-hmm. which is so often the experience, you know, being a Black person in predominantly white environments. So like I could be, you know, the weird kid or like the nerdy kid or like whatever. I could be all those things, that I never was like the Black anything.
Yeah.
And that was like really, really, really important, just, you know, like in my identity formation as a young adult, to be able to be in an environment where it wasn't all it. I wasn't having that outsider, like interloper feeling that can be put upon Black folks in predominantly white spaces.
Yes, that's fascinating.
And then just, you know, like having a lot of my culture centered. So like the music studies at Howard, everyone takes African and African American music literature. Like our core, even music literature teaching was like in Black folks. It's something that, yeah, a lot of people are fortunate to get.
So when you came, when you graduated then with your master's, then you decided to go into teaching music as, mm-hmm. as your main career at that time?
Yeah, I was married at the time and my ex-husband lived here in Fort Worth. So we came down and I got to a point of like, it's time to have a job with benefits that incorporates something that I already love. And like, I feel good about doing mm-hmm. the job. And I was like, okay, I've done some like graduate teaching and some private lessons and such. So I figured I would try grade school music and went in not knowing as much as I needed to know. So like my performance studies helped a lot as an educator, but the pedagogy had to play catch up on. And I ended up in the classroom for 12 years.
So when you say grade school, is that like elementary school
mm-hmm.
in the States? So children under 11 or something?
Yeah, it was either like 5 to 11 mm-hmm. or sometimes the babies I get like 4. To 11, yeah.
And one of the other interesting parts of what you do these days is you founded the nonprofit Decolonizing the Music Room.
Mm-hmm.
What was the sort of genesis of that? Was that kind of while you were still teaching in schools, and was there a crossover there?
Yeah, it started up with the research and writing and stuff I was doing while I was still teaching.
In a nutshell, again, you wear so many hats and there's so much intricate stuff in all of them, but can you kind of give us a little bit of a summary of what it does?
Yeah. So our mission is centering Black, Brown, Indigenous, and Asian folks in music, education, research, performance. And so we have programs. FWAMFest is actually our first program underneath the nonprofit. And we have a Black, Brown, Indigenous, and Asian music symposium. And we have a visiting artist educator program, which is basically me connecting with master artists of all different lanes and bringing them in to do workshops or perform, just really flexible format. The way that we started was with a website full of free resources that we still maintain for educators and people mm-hmm. in other disciplines. I reached out to a group of educators and we brainstormed and we got enough content together to launch Decolonize the Music Room as a site before it was an organization. This was June 2019 mm-hmm. that the website launched. And by, you know, kind of fall, we were looking like, you know, exactly what is this? We were starting to get asked to present. And my colleague, who is our lead editor and content coordinator, Dr. Lorelei Batiste-Long, we talked and we're like, we're doing a lot of the planning and administrative and managing load. And do we want this to be a for-profit business or a nonprofit? Either path is fairly fraught, but I felt because we were mission-based, it was best to go the nonprofit yeah. route. And so the other thing we get asked to do a lot is to present at conferences, to organizations, schools, and sometimes do some consulting work as well.
So for instance, like, would that be schools or regions of education boards, or, you know, I'm not quite as familiar as how it's set up in the US.
Yeah.
Who want to be kind of filling gaps in the music education of children?
Mm-hmm. So there are the music ed conferences that, you know, will tend to be something countrywide mm-hmm. that people will come to. One of the big annual conferences, we get asked to present those the most. And also music ed organizations who have their like state and metro area and regional chapters will ask us to come in, some actual colleges and universities. And there are a lot of other like one-off things that fall under the general umbrella, but those three are the ones we get asked to do most often. And it is very much like, I think of it as like teaching adults how to have an approach that ends up benefiting kids once they get back into the classroom.
Yeah. I think I might have first come across your work through the Decolonizing the Music Room angle. As an event organizer and a promoter, music promoter, I was trying to learn more about Black influences in Americana, bluegrass, old-time music, which is kind of my favored kind of music to showcase.
Yeah.
Being over here in the UK, it's like it's a niche music within a niche in a way. So you're almost then educating people who are even further away from what it actually is.
And there's a lot of similarities to that here as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think the angle I might have, you know, learned about your work from was trying to learn more about making the bluegrass and old time scene here in the UK more welcoming to mm-hmm. people who weren't necessarily familiar with it. I think it was about problematic tunes or songs and really becoming aware of the origins of some of these old tunes and songs, and, you know, that a lot of them are not harmless and they're actually rooted in some really horrendous history.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you get a lot of, I'm sure you get a lot more pushback for raising these issues and saying, you don't need to mm-hmm. play such and such a tune because that's, you know, was actually originally associated with violence mm-hmm. or, you know, terrible things. How have you found the sort of, do you get a kind of reactionary pushback to some of these educational
yeah.
elements?
Yeah, and part of that pushback led to the formation of Decolonize the Music Room. There, you know, are so many people who I don't think they realize that historically our society has had Black folks as not like fully human. And deeply internalize that in every like bit, every system, through the media and so on and so on. So a lot of the resistance I feel is not really seeing our full humanity and why it has a certain impact to make music when we know certain tunes are specifically rooted in harmful stuff. And there are a lot of people who just it's almost like not wanting to let go of that, you know, that good old days, like sentimentality. Like, I've heard this tune since I was growing up. This is dear to me. And feeling immediately defensive about the idea of not having that tune anymore. And from my point of view, I understand when people are defensive, but my approach to it is, you know, let me go process that and figure that out while I also stop doing the thing that someone has already told me is harmful based on their experience. But tons and tons of pushback. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it, where you think, well, surely for you, that's a trivial matter to not play that tune anymore. Like, you're not, it's really not that important to you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had a kind of similar thing, related matter here, where friends of mine who the woman in the relationship is African-American and her spouse is English, white English. And there was a bit of a debate going on about the flag, the Confederate flag.
Oh, boy.
And why it's not acceptable to have it displayed, yeah. Which, of course, over here, there's a lot of ignorance about it. And people, I think generally, people who defend it, they see it as some decorative thing that denotes country music and the Dukes of Hazzard TV series from the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And this musician, he wrote an article in our, you know, Association Bluegrass magazine explaining how his wife found it absolutely terrifying to go to an event, mm-hmm. a festival here in the UK and see the Confederate flag flying because mm-hmm. of the very real associations. And, you know, some people just wrote back letters like complaining that, oh, you know, that's not what it is. And it's like,
right.
Why? You know, you have been told about this person's lived experience, somebody who actually really knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
About the significance. Why are you defending this when to you it's just a cartoon, a bit of nothing? It's very strange.
Yeah. And honestly, the way, again, like the way that these images and things have been portrayed and the lack of like seeing the full humanity of Black folks and feeling entitled to whatever. And I hate when people say, you know, is someone racist, is someone not, like, whether or not that's beside the point. The point is, like, are you perpetuating something that is harmful?
Yes.
People get hung up on, like, being called a racist, and it's like, let's just look at the action. Mm-hmm. Is the action you took something that someone is telling you caused them harm? And it's interesting to hear that point of view from someone like across the pond, because, you know, like when we talk about white supremacy and whiteness, it describes like a system of oppression and who has been allowed, you know, property, go back far enough, people as property, like who has most access to rights and all of that. It's not culture, so to speak. Like, whiteness is really framed as like the amount of like entitlement and access and oppression. But like, you know, Irish is a culture and Scandinavian is, you know, like that's that disconnect. You know, even thinking of the Confederate flag, people talk about like the cultural aspect to it, historical aspect to it. And it's like, if your symbol meant certain things, it meant something as awful as it means to folks, then you might want to reevaluate that. And there's a lot of argument about, you know, like states' rights, so on and so on. It's like, no, the Confederacy explicitly wanted to preserve mm-hmm. the oppression and ownership of enslaved Black folks. It's like a constant conversation.
Following the thread through, and in terms of like the slant of your work, which is centering Blackness and underrepresented voices in, you know, music, decolonizing the music room, etc. In terms of the moment we're in now, although I'm sure as a Black American woman, you've got a longer term view. But I mean, are we in a time where anything, any culture, any events or programs that are even mentioning Black folks or women are at risk?
Right.
How do you, you know, are your funders solid, or how are you sort of navigating this moment?
So we're only in fiscal year 5. So there's not a solid anyway. It's still very much building. Obviously, now there's a different slant to it. And it always was an issue of the disparity in attention and funding that organizations that focused on racially minoritized people get, or specifically organizations led by Black women and femmes. So there's been a huge element of precarity to what I've been doing the entire time that mirrors, I feel like, the precarity of like my position as a Black femme in the US in this time in history. The precarity is different. Like rather than some danger and just worrying about making ends meet, now it's like ramped up levels of danger that, you know, are extending to all of my colleagues and peers. Like, not new stuff, obviously, but just more overt.
Yeah.
And I try to keep in mind that, you know, everybody's got their lane and they've got their stuff they have to do. And, you know, my work is for a purpose. And I'm still driven by that, you know, regardless of whatever label it's under. So I'm cautious, but for right now, my attention in that area is more on like what's happening to colleagues and peers, knowing that like what's going on with my organization hasn't shifted a huge amount yet. And there are some of like the major funders, like, you know, the NEA, that were very heavily affected immediately by this administration's changes. But
is that the National Endowment for the Arts?
Yeah.
So that's a kind of one of the biggest arts funders.
Yeah.
Although, to be honest, Americans don't get a lot of arts funding support anyway.
We do not.
Podcast is really all about centering women working in rich music, and I've been asking my guests what's their experiences of, you know, navigating the music scene, the touring business if they're a touring musician, but then obviously your work is kind of much broader across a whole portfolio of things as musician, as organizer.
Yeah.
What's your experience, especially as a Black woman in music? How do you see the particular challenges that women face in the music sector?
Yeah, I feel like I can never talk about my womanness without talking about my Blackness, mm-hmm. because that intersection is uniquely, well, it isn't the issue. People's treatment of and view of that intersection is a big issue. So there are a lot of things related to that have just been pervasive in general. I am accustomed to not necessarily being looked at like I know what I'm doing. So
in terms of gatekeepers' reactions to you, or
yeah, and it's not even like it doesn't feel mean or anything. It's just like, let me inform you about what you're obviously right in front of me doing. A lot of mansplaining and just, you know, not being looked at as if like I am part of the scene. I am a little luckier because I was never a touring artist, and my connections when I got into old time happened in kind of a different way, especially like a lot over the internet and stuff. So a lot of my performance experience will be like someone specifically asking me,
yeah,
who knows what I do already, and I'm there because they invited me into the space. From a booking perspective, what's cool about the festival is when artists come in and they appreciate that there is a space that's centered around Black folks. And I talk especially with my Black women peers about like the stuff that they have to deal with on the road and how, you know, it's kind of a little like exhale, you know, we end up together and you just kind of breathe for just a sec before you have to go back out there. Cause
that's a valuable venting space, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And just, you know, just being joyful together, because one of the biggest things for Black women is just, you know, I've had peers talk about their name being on the marquee and still being treated by security as if they didn't belong in the space. All that kind of stuff comes up. But we're very intentional about connecting with one another and making sure that we have that joy and stuff together to balance out those types of things. And just knowing that, like, we have to assert ourselves so much more elsewhere, mm-hmm. just, you know, just to be able to exist in the way we should exist without issue.
One of the things I admire about you is your fearlessness in dealing with this stuff. I saw that you were involved in the symposium at the IBMA.
The Black String Band Symposium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Black String Band Symposium at the International Bluegrass Music Association last autumn. And I booked an online ticket for that. There was a whole raft of interesting sessions and panels and some bits of performances and all sorts of themes. And one thing that I recall is that I think it was an older white man. Obviously, I was kind of seeing just the panel.
I know exactly.
This individual basically came out with a load of completely false statement. And you actually tackled him, which was great because it was sort of at the end of the session and the panel were wrapping up.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts in those moments? Or do you just think, I'm not gonna stand for this. I'm gonna put this right.
That's basically it. Like, I got to a point long ago where it's like, if they have the audacity to be loud and wrong, we're going to now all be talking out loud in front of everyone about how much of an issue that was. And I remember after that, I guess he kind of slunk out of the room pretty quickly.
Was it a discredited story about the origin of the banjo? I'm trying to remember what the exact thing was.
Yes. It was like the Joel Sweetie created the, you know, like that whole thing.
After we've already had an hour of erudite discussion, an enlightening discussion.
Two full days, in fact.
Well, yes.
Again, I talk about like whiteness as a system, like, of oppression, of like power wielding, of entitlement, right? Like, that is whiteness, where he feels as he can come in to something that's centered around Black folks, listen, and then be like, I'm still going to assert this thing that like centers, like ahistorically and completely falsely centers white men as the creator of banjos and like this. It's just a mess. And again, I like to say and represent like whiteness, not white people, right? That man has a whole culture somewhere that is completely not part of like the way that he wielded that systemic whiteness, and just was like, I'm going to tell experts what, like,
I just wondered whether he'd come in specifically to say that, because I think the actual point had already been dissected earlier.
That is what I think he did. Yeah, yeah. I think he was just like, I'm going to go, you know, neg, I guess.
Make some mischief.
Uh-huh. But then again, the assumption is that no pushback is going to happen. And it's like, no, we don't operate like that.
Which is, I think, is admirable. The IBMA seemed to have at least made some moves to being more, the leadership of the IBMA seem to have been taking some steps to actually center some Black voices and actually look at, you know, acknowledging the real history of these things.
Mm-hmm. There's been some movement and intention in that area. I think everything is pretty incremental or slower, and you know, like they've had me in for presentations. We had the Black String Band Symposium, but it's not as simple as we said the name, we had the panels, we had such and such. It's like what is being done to make like a material difference in terms of who is in the space, how they're compensated. Like I'm a big believer in like, if I'm here to help diversify or help fix the issue of something being exclusive, then like you need to be compensated for that. And that's not yet a norm for so many organizations and groups and projects. So it's like, you know, IBMA, the scene, everything is like, there are some things and it's always, always good to have something. But, you know, like real talk, we could turn things completely upside down in a good way in a fairly short amount of time. But that is not really something that that mainstream communities, I shouldn't even really say mainstream because it's like across the board, like that's not something that folks are ready for. So yeah, just, you know, there's headway and I'm happy to go and see my other like Black peers there and stuff. But like there's still things that make it very obvious how far we have to go.
Yeah.
I've reached a point in my life where like I feel like I've built up the type of career that I want to have, and it just needs to be sustainable because it's rewarding and I get to be in community with so many great people and do stuff like talk on a podcast with someone in England. Like
yeah. Well, clearly, yeah, you're driven by your love for your subject, for music, for justice, for education, and it isn't about the money, but it would be nice if it were more fairly recompensed. The world we live in is a bit topsy-turvy.
Yeah, because capitalism is beating us all up. I don't need to be wealthy. I need a truly yes. livable wage where I can, you know, also afford to have enjoyment as a human.
Exactly.
But I think that like everyone should have that. Like you, our level of productivity or not, like we just deserve that.
Yeah. So what do you have coming up in the rest of the year? Does the Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival take like a whole year to put together? Are you already looking at 2026?
Are you looking at 2026? There's always an overlap. Yes. So like it's every March, but then January, I start looking at the next year.
Wow.
So I've been doing some booking and some planning already, and we're contracted out with our venue until 2029. So it's really easy for me to go ahead and start making plans. Later in the year, I do get to play the Austin String Band Festival, which I'm really excited about because I've played it in a duo. I was in a duo, Pace and Barber, a few years back, and we played it. But now I get to play it just as me. Okay. And yeah, it's exciting to get out there. And then, of course, we'll see. If I'm back up at IBMA, I think I might be able to hit Americana Fest this year. I'm on the board of Folk Alliance International, and so yes. we might be able to be up there. And yeah, that also gets me like into a whole other world of cool events and such.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Brandy. Where can people go if they want to learn more about what you do?
Mm-hmm. My site is brandypacemusic.com, BrandiPaceMusic.com. BrandyPaceMusic.com, Brandy Pace Music on Instagram. And you can go to my site and get to Decolonize in the Music Room, Flam Fest, and see the hats I wear.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for all the important work you do.
Thank you.
I'll put these links in the show notes. I wish you much continued success with the festival and all the different parts of your music career. And thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Women Folk was produced and presented by me, Maria Wallace. Check out the show notes to find out more about Brandy Waller-Pace and her work with Decolonizing the Music Room and the Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival. You can subscribe, download, and listen to episodes of Women Folk wherever you get your podcasts, or visit my website truenorthmusic.co.uk for more information and links. Follow us on social media at womenfolkpod on Instagram and at facebook.com/womenfolkpod. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.